as they reveal about the creature standing before me. He has, of course, another, quite different identity. As an animal, I mean, connected as all animals must be to certain other animals and plants and microbes, as well as to the earth and the sun. He's a link in a food chain, a thread in a far-reaching web of ecological relationships. Looked at from this perspective, everything going on in this cattle pen appears quite different, and not nearly as far removed from our world as this manure-encrusted patch of ground here in nowhere, Kansas, might suggest. For one thing, the health of these animals is inextricably linked to our own by that web of relationships. The unnaturally rich diet of corn that undermines a steer's health fattens his flesh in a way that undermines the health of the humans who will eat it. The antibiotics these animals consume with their corn at this very moment are selecting, in their gut and wherever else in the environment they end up, for new strains of resistant bacteria that will someday infect us and withstand the drugs we depend on to treat that infection. We inhabit the same microbial ecosystem as the animals we eat, and whatever happens in it also happens to us. Then there's the deep pile of manure on which I stand, in which 534 sleeps. We don't know much about the hormones in it, where they will end up, or what they might do once they get there. But we do know something about the bacteria, which can find their way from the manure on the ground to his hide, and from there into our hamburgers. The speed at which these animals will be slaughtered and processed. 400 an hour at the plant where 534 will go, means that sooner or later some of the manure caked on these hides gets into the meat we eat. One of the bacteria that almost certainly resides in the manure I'm standing on is particularly lethal to humans. Escherichia coli 0157H7 is a relatively new strain of the common intestinal bacteria, no one had seen it before 1980, that thrives in feedlot cattle, 40% of which carry it in their gut. Ingesting as few as 10 of these microbes can cause a fatal infection. They produce a toxin that destroys human kidneys. Most of the microbes that reside in the gut of a cow and find their way into our food get killed off by the strong acids in our stomachs, since they evolved to live in the neutral pH environment of the rumen. But the rumen of a corn-fed feedlot steer is nearly as acidic as our own, and in this new man-made environment, new acid-resistant strains of E. coli, of which 0157H7 is one, have evolved. Yet another creature recruited by nature to absorb the excess biomass coming off the farm belt. The problem with these bugs is that they can shake off the acid bath in our stomachs, and then go on to kill us. By acidifying the rumen with corn, we've broken down one of our food chain's most important barriers to infection. Yet another solution turned into a problem. We've recently discovered that this process of acidification can be reversed, and that doing so can greatly diminish the threat from E. coli 0157H7. Jim Russell, a USDA microbiologist on the faculty at Cornell, has found that switching a cow's diet from corn to grass or hay for a few days prior to slaughter reduces the population of E. coli 0157H7 in the animal's gut by as much as 80%. But such a solution, grass, is considered wildly impractical by the cattle industry and, therefore, by the USDA. Their preferred solution for dealing with bacterial contamination is irradiation, essentially to try to sterilize the manure getting into the meat. So much comes back to corn, this cheap feed that turns out in so many ways to be not cheap at all. While I stood in Pen 63, a dump truck pulled up alongside the feed bunk and released a golden stream of feed. The black mass of cowhide moved toward the trough for lunch. The $1.60 a day I'm paying for three meals a day here is a bargain only by the narrowest of calculations. It doesn't take into account, for example, the cost to the public health of antibiotic resistance or food poisoning by E. coli 0157H7. It doesn't take into account the cost to taxpayers of the farm subsidies that keep Pokey's raw materials cheap. and it certainly doesn't take into account all the many environmental costs incurred by cheap corn. I stood alongside 534 as he lowered his big head into the stream of fresh grain. How absurd, I thought, the two of us standing hock deep in manure in this godforsaken place, overlooking a manure lagoon in the middle of nowhere somewhere in Kansas. Godforsaken, perhaps, and yet not apart, I realized, as I thought of the other places connected to this place by the river of commodity corn. Follow the corn from this bunk back to the fields where it grows, and I'd find myself back in the middle of that 125,000-mile square monoculture, under a steady rain of pesticide and fertilizer. Keep going, and I could follow the nitrogen runoff from that fertilizer all the way down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico, adding its poison to an 8,000-square-mile zone so starved of oxygen nothing but algae can live in it. And then go farther still. Follow the fertilizer and the diesel fuel and the petrochemical pesticides needed to grow the corn all the way to the oil fields of the Persian Gulf. I don't have a sufficiently vivid imagination to look at my steer and see a barrel of oil, but petroleum is one of the most important ingredients in the production of modern meat, and the Persian Gulf is surely a link in the food chain that passes through this or any feedlot. Steer 534 started his life part of a food chain that derived all of its energy from the sun, which nourished the grasses that nourished him and his mother. When 534 moved from ranch to feedlot, from grass to corn, he joined an industrial food chain powered by fossil fuel, and therefore defended by the U.S. military, another never-counted cost of cheap food. One-fifth of America's petroleum consumption goes to producing and transporting our food. After I got home from Kansas, I asked an economist who specializes in agriculture and energy if it might be possible to calculate precisely how much petroleum it will take to grow my steer to slaughter weight. Assuming 534 continues to eat 25 pounds of corn a day and reaches a weight of 1,200 pounds, he will have consumed in his lifetime the equivalent of 35 gallons of oil, nearly a barrel. So this is what commodity corn can do to a cow. Industrialize the miracle of nature that is a ruminant, taking this sunlight and prairie grass-powered organism and turning it into the last thing we need, another fossil fuel machine. This one, however, is able to suffer. Standing there in the pen alongside my steer, I couldn't imagine ever wanting to eat the flesh of one of these protein machines. Hungry was the last thing I felt. Yet I'm sure that after enough time goes by, and the stink of this place is gone from my nostrils, I will eat feedlot beef again. Eating industrial meat takes an almost heroic act of not knowing or, now, forgetting. But I left Pokey determined to follow this meat to a meal on a table somewhere, to see this food chain at least that far. I was curious to know what feedlot beef would taste like now, if I could taste the corn, or even, since taste is as much a matter of what's in the head as it is about molecules dancing on the tongue, a hint of the petroleum. You are what you eat is a truism hard to argue with, and yet it is, as a visit to a feedlot suggests, incomplete. For you are what you eat eats too. And what we are, or have become, is not just meat, but number two corn and oil. Chapter 5. The Processing Plant. Making Complex Foods. 18,000 Kernels. Taking the Kernel Apart. The Mill. One of the truly odd things about the 10 billion bushels of corn harvested each year is how little of it we eat. Sure, we grind some of it to make cornmeal, but most of the corn we eat as corn, whether on the cob, flaked, or baked into muffins or tortillas or chips, comes from varieties other than number two, usually sweet corn or white corn. These uses represent a tiny fraction of the harvest, less than a bushel per person per year, which is probably why we don't think of ourselves as big corn eaters. And yet each of us is personally responsible for consuming a ton of the stuff every year. Much of the rest of that per capita ton does enter our bodies, but not before it has been heavily processed, broken down into simple compounds either by animals like Steer 534 or a processing plant, and then reassembled either as beef, chicken, or pork, or as soft drinks, breakfast cereals, or snacks. What doesn't pass through the gut of a food animal to become meat will pass through one of America's 25 wet mills on its way to becoming one of the innumerable products food science has figured out how to tease from a kernel of corn. These mills are called wet to distinguish them from the traditional mills where corn is simply ground into dry meal for things like tortillas. About a fifth of the corn river flowing out from the elevators at the Iowa Farmers Cooperative travels to a wet milling plant, usually by train. There it diverges into a great many slender branching tributaries, only to converge much later on a plate or in a cup. For what the wet mill does to a bushel of corn is to turn it into the building blocks from which companies like General Mills, McDonald's, and Coca-Cola assemble our processed foods. The first rough breakdown of all that corn begins with the subdivision of the kernel itself. Its yellow skin will be processed into various vitamins and nutritional supplements. The tiny germ, the dark part nearest the cob, which holds the embryo of the potential future corn plant, will be crushed for its oil. And the biggest part, the endosperm, will be plundered for its rich cache of complex carbohydrate. This oversized packet of starch is corn's most important contribution to the industrial food chain. An abundance of carbohydrate molecules in long chains that chemists have learned to break down and then rearrange into hundreds of different organic compounds. Acids, sugars, starches, and alcohols. The names of many of these compounds will be familiar to anyone who's studied the ingredient label on a package of processed food. Citric and lactic acid, glucose, fructose and maltodextrin, ethanol for alcoholic beverages as well as cars, sorbitol, mannitol, and xanthan gum, modified and unmodified starch, as well as dextrins and cyclodextrins and MSG, to name only a few. To watch the stream of corn coming off of George Naylor's farm proceed to divide, subdivide, and ultimately branch off into a molecule of fructose destined to sweeten a soda is not as easy as following it to a feedlot into a cut of meat. For one thing, the two companies who wet mill most of America's corn, Cargill and ADM, declined to let me watch them do it. For another, the process is largely invisible, since it takes place inside a series of sealed vats, pipes, fermentation tanks, and filters. Even so, I would have liked to follow my bushel of corn through ADM's plant in Decatur, Illinois, the unofficial capital of corn processing in America, or to Cargill's mill in Iowa City, the likely destination of the train I saw being loaded at the elevator in Jefferson. But the industrial food chain goes underground, in effect, as it passes through these places on its path to our plates. The closest I got to following corn through a mill was at the Center for Crops Utilization Research at Iowa State University, in Ames, 45 miles from the Farmers Cooperative elevator in Jefferson. After my visit to George Naylor's farm, I spent a couple of days on the Ames campus, which really should be called the University of Corn. Corn is the hero of the most prominent sculptures and murals on campus, and the work of the institution is dedicated in large part to the genetics, culture, history, and uses of this plant, though the soybean, Iowa's second crop, gets its share of attention too. The Center for Crops Utilization Research is charged with developing new uses for America's corn and soybean surplus, and to this end operates a scaled-down wet milling operation, a Rube Goldberg contraption of stainless steel tubes, pipes, valves, vents, drying tables, centrifuges, filters, and tanks that Larry Johnson, the center's director, was more than happy to show me. To hear Johnson describe it, the wet milling process is essentially an industrial version of digestion. A food is broken down through a series of steps that includes the application of physical pressure, acids, and enzymes. The order of the steps is different in industrial digestion. The acids come before the mechanical chewing, for instance, but the results are much the same. A complex food is reduced to simple molecules, mostly sugars. First, we separate the corn into its botanical parts, embryo, endosperm, fiber, and then into its chemical parts, Johnson explained as we began our tour of the plant. When a shipment of corn arrives at the mill, it is steeped for 36 hours in a bath of water containing a small amount of sulfur dioxide. The acid bath swells the kernels and frees the starch from the proteins that surround it. After the soak, the swollen kernels are ground in a mill. By now the germ is rubbery and it pops right off, Johnson explained. We take the slurry to a hydroclone, basically a centrifuge for liquids, where the germ floats off. After it's dried, we squeeze it for corn oil. Corn oil can be used as a cooking or salad oil, or hydrogenated for use in margarine and other processed foods. Atoms of hydrogen are forced into the fat molecule to make it solid at room temperature. Though originally designed as a healthy substitute for animal fats, medical researchers now think these trans fats are actually worse for our arteries than butter. Once the germ has been removed and the kernels crushed, what's left is a white mush of protein and starch called mill starch. To draw off as much of the protein as possible, the mill starch undergoes a progressively finer series of grindings and filterings and centrifuges. The extracted protein, called gluten, is used in animal feed. At each step, more fresh water is added. It takes about 5 gallons to process a bushel of corn, and prodigious amounts of energy. Wet milling is an energy-intensive way to make food. For every calorie of processed food it produces, another 10 calories of fossil fuel energy are burned. At this point, the process has yielded a white slurry that's poured out onto a stainless table and dried to a fine, super-white powder, cornstarch. Cornstarch comprised wet milling's sole product when the industry got its start in the 1840s. At first, the laundry business was its biggest customer, but cooks and early food processors soon began adding cornstarch to as many recipes as they could. It offered the glamour of modernity, purity, and absolute whiteness. By 1866, corn refiners had learned how to use acids to break down cornstarch into glucose, and sweeteners quickly became, as they remain today, the industry's most important product. Corn syrup, which is mostly glucose or dextrose, the terms are interchangeable, became the first cheap domestic substitute for cane sugar. I remember an elementary school science experiment in which we were instructed to chew, and chew, and chew, a cracker until the slurry of starch turned suddenly sweet on our tongues. The teacher explained that the enzymes in our saliva had broken the long starch molecules into shorter molecules of glucose. Much the same process, it's called enzyme hydrolysis, revolutionized corn refining in the 1940s. As enzymes replaced acids, refiners were able to produce progressively sweeter sweeteners from corn. Yet none were quite as sweet as sugar, or to be more precise, sucrose. That threshold wasn't crossed until the late 1960s, when Japanese chemists broke the sweetness barrier, in the words of the Corn Refiners Association's official history of high fructose corn sweetener. They discovered that an enzyme called glucose isomerase could transform glucose into the much sweeter sugar molecule called fructose. By the 1970s, the process of refining corn into fructose had been perfected, and high fructose corn syrup, which is a blend of 55% fructose and 45% glucose that tastes exactly as sweet as sucrose, came onto the market. Today it is the most valuable food product refined from corn, accounting for 550 million bushels every year. A bushel of corn yields 33 pounds of fructose. But if the pipe marked HFCS leads to the fattest spigot at the far end of a corn refinery's bewildering tangle of pipes and valves, it is by no means the only spigot you'll find back there. There are dozens of other output streams. At various points along its way through the mill, some portion of the thick, white slurry of starch is diverted to be dedicated to another purpose, or, in the refiner's jargon, another fraction. The starch itself is capable of being modified into spherical, crystalline, or highly branched molecules, each suitable for a different use. Adhesives, coatings, sizings, and plastics for industry, stabilizers, thickeners, gels, and viscosity control agents for food. What remains in the slurry is saccharified, treated with enzymes that turn it into dextrose syrup. A portion of this dextrose is siphoned off for use as corn syrup. Other fractions are recruited to become sugars like maltodextrin and maltose. The largest portion of the corn syrup stream is piped into a tank where it is exposed to glucose isomerase enzymes and then passed through ion exchange filters, emerging eventually as fructose. Now what's left of the dextrose stream is piped into a fermentation tank where yeasts or amino acids go to work eating the sugars, in several hours yielding an alcoholic brew. This is itself fractionated into various alcohols, ethanol chief among them, our gas tanks being the ultimate destination of a tenth of the corn crop. The fermented brew can also be refined into a dozen different organic and amino acids for use in food processing or the manufacture of plastic. And then, that's about it. There's no corn left, and not much of anything else either, except for some dirty water. Though even some of this steep water is used to make animal feeds. The primary difference between the industrial digestion of corn and an animal's is that in this case, there is virtually no waste at the end of it. Step back for a moment and behold this great, intricately piped stainless steel beast. This is the supremely adapted creature that has evolved to help eat the vast surplus biomass coming off America's farms, efficiently digesting the millions of bushels of corn fed to it each day by the trainload. Go around back of this beast and you'll see 100 different spigots, large and small, filling tanker cars of other trains with HFCS, ethanol, syrups, starches, and food additives of every description. The question now is, who or what, besides our cars, is going to consume and digest all this freshly fractionated biomass? The sugars and starches, the alcohols and acids, the emulsifiers and stabilizers and viscosity control agents. This is where we come in. It takes a certain kind of eater, an industrial eater, to consume these fractions of corn, and we are, or have evolved into, that supremely adapted creature, the eater of processed food. Putting it back together again. Processed foods. The dream of liberating food from nature is as old as eating. People began processing food to keep nature from taking it back. What is spoilage, after all, if not nature operating through her proxy microorganisms, repossessing our hard-won lunch? So we learned to salt and dry and cure and pickle in the first age of food processing, and to can, freeze, and vacuum pack in the second. These technologies were blessings, freeing people from nature's cycles of abundance and scarcity, as well as from the tyranny of the calendar or locale. Now a New Englander could eat sweet corn, or something reminiscent of it, in January, and taste a pineapple for the first time in his life. As Massimo Montanari, an Italian food historian, points out, the fresh, local, and seasonal food we prize today was, for most of human history, a form of slavery, since it left us utterly at the mercy of the local vicissitudes of nature. Even after people had learned the rudiments of preserving food, however, the dream of liberating food from nature continued to flourish, indeed, to expand in ambition and confidence. In the third age of food processing, which begins with the end of World War II, merely preserving the fruits of nature was deemed too modest. The goal now was to improve on nature. The 20th century prestige of technology and convenience combined with advances in marketing to push aside butter to make shelf space for margarine, replace fruit juice with juice drinks and then entirely juice-free drinks like Tang, cheese with Cheese Whiz and whipped cream with Ready Whip. Corn, a species that had been a modest beneficiary of the first two ages of food processing, having taken well to the can and the freezer, really came into its own during the third. You would never know it without reading the ingredient label, a literary genre unknown until the third age, But corn is the key constituent of all four of these processed foods. Along with the soybean, its rotational partner in the field, corn has done more than any other species to help the food industry realize the dream of freeing food from nature's limitations and seducing the omnivore into eating more of a single plant than anyone would ever have thought possible. In fact, you would be hard-pressed to find a late-model processed food that isn't made from corn or soybeans. In the typical formulation, corn supplies the carbohydrates, sugars, and starches, and soy the protein. The fat can come from either plant. Remember what George Naylor said about the real produce of his farm: not corn and soybeans, but energy and protein. The longer the ingredient label on a food, the more fractions of corn and soybeans you will find in it. They supply the essential building blocks, and from those two plants, plus a handful of synthetic additives, a food scientist can construct just about any processed food he or she can dream up. A few years ago, in the days when food security meant something very different than it does today, I had the chance to visit one of the small handful of places where this kind of work is done. The Bell Institute, a leafy corporate campus on the outskirts of Minneapolis, is the research and development laboratory for General Mills, the sixth largest food company in the world. Here, 900 food scientists spend their days designing the future of food, its flavor, texture, and packaging. Much of their work is highly secretive, but nowhere more so than in the cereals area. Deep in the heart of the Bell Institute, down in the bowels of the laboratory, you come to a warren of windowless rooms called, rather grandly, the Institute of Cereal Technology. I was permitted to pass through a high-security conference room furnished with a horseshoe-shaped table that had a pair of headphones at every seat. This was the Institute's inner sanctum, the Cereal Situation Room, where General Mills executives gather to hear briefings about new products. The secrecy surrounding the successor to Cocoa Pebbles struck me as laughable, and I said so. But as an executive explained to me, recipes are not intellectual property. You can't patent a new cereal. All you can hope for is to have the market to yourself for a few months to establish your brand before a competitor knocks off the product. So we're very careful not to show our hand. For the same reason, the Institute operates its own machine shop, where it designs and builds the machines that give breakfast cereals their shapes, making it that much harder for a competitor to knock off, say, a new marshmallow bit shaped to resemble a shooting star. In the interests of secrecy, the food scientists would not talk to me about current projects, only past failures, like the breakthrough cereal in the shapes of little bowling pins and balls. In focus group, the kids loved it, the product's rueful inventor told me. But the mothers didn't like the idea of kids bowling their breakfast across the table, which is why bowling pin cereal never showed up in your supermarket. In many ways, breakfast cereal is the prototypical processed food. 4 cents worth of commodity corn, or some other equally cheap grain, transformed into $4 worth of processed food. What an alchemy! Yet it is performed straightforwardly enough. By taking several of the output streams issuing from a wet mill, cornmeal, cornstarch, corn sweetener, as well as a handful of tinier chemical fractions, and then assembling them into an attractively novel form. Further value is added in the form of color and taste, then branding and packaging. Oh yes, and vitamins and minerals, which are added to give the product a sheen of healthfulness and to replace the nutrients that are lost whenever whole foods are processed. On the strength of this alchemy, the cereals group generates higher profits for General Mills than any other division. Since the raw materials in processed foods are so abundant and cheap, ADM and Cargill will gladly sell them to all comers. Protecting whatever is special about the value you add to them is imperative. I think it was at General Mills that I first heard the term food system. Since then, I've seen in the pages of Food Technology, the monthly Bible of the food processing industry, that this term seems to be taking over from plain old food. Food system is glossier and more high-tech than food, I guess. It also escapes some of the negative connotations that got attached to processed food during the 60s. It's probably as good a term as any when you're describing, as that magazine routinely does, new edible materials constructed from textured vegetable protein, or a nutraceutical breakfast cereal so fortified with green tea, grapeseed extract, and antioxidants that it's not even called a cereal but a healthy heart system. Exactly what corn is doing in such food systems has less to do with nutrition or taste than with economics. For the dream of liberating food from nature, which began as a dream of the eaters, to make it less perishable, is now primarily a dream of the feeders, of the corporations that sell us our food. No one was clamoring for synthetic cheese or a cereal shaped like a bowling pin. Processed food has become largely a supply-driven business. The business of figuring out clever ways to package and market the glut of commodities coming off the farm and out of the wet mills. Today, the great advantages of processing food redound to the processors themselves. For them, nature is foremost a problem. Not so much of perishable food, though that's always a concern when your market is global, as of perishable profits. Like every other food chain, the industrial food chain is rooted at either end in a natural system, the farmer's field at one end and the human organism at the other. From the capitalist's point of view, both of these systems are less than ideal. The farm, being vulnerable to the vicissitudes of weather and pests, is prone to crises of over- and underproduction, both of which can hurt business. Rising raw material prices cut into profits. Obviously enough. Yet the potential boon of falling raw material prices, which should allow you to sell a lot more of your product at a lower price, can't be realized in the case of food because of the special nature of your consumer, who can only eat so much food, no matter how cheap it gets. Food industry executives used to call this the problem of the fixed stomach. Economists speak of inelastic demand. Nature has cursed the companies working the middle of the food chain with a recipe for falling rates of profits. The growth of the American food industry will always bump up against this troublesome biological fact. Try as we might, each of us can eat only about 1,500 pounds of food a year. Unlike many other products, CDs, say, or shoes, there's a natural limit to how much food we can each consume without exploding. What this means for the food industry is that its natural rate of growth is somewhere around 1% per year, 1% being the annual growth rate of the American population. The problem is that 1% will never satisfy Wall Street, which demands at the very least a 10% return on its capital. This leaves companies like General Mills and McDonald's with two options if they hope to grow faster than the population. Figure out how to get people to spend more money for the same 3/4 of a ton of food, or entice them to actually eat more than that. The two strategies are not mutually exclusive, of course, and the food industry energetically pursues them both at the same time, which is good news indeed for the hero of our story, for it happens that turning cheap corn into complex food systems is an excellent way to achieve both goals. End of Disc 3. Building processed food out of a commodity like corn doesn't completely cushion you from the vicissitudes of nature, but it comes close. The more complex your food system, the more you can practice substitutionism without altering the taste or appearance of the product. So if the price of hydrogenated fat or lecithin derived from corn spikes one day, you simply switch to fat or lecithin from soy, and the consumer will never know the difference. This is why ingredient labels say things like contains one or more of the following: corn, soybean, or sunflower oil. As a management consultant once advised his food industry clients, the further a product's identity moves from a specific raw material, that is, the more processing steps involved, the less vulnerable is its processor to the variability of nature. In fact, there are lots of good reasons to complicate your product. Or, as the industry prefers to say, to add value to it. Processing food can add months, even years to its shelf life, allowing you to market globally. Complicating your product also allows you to capture more of the money a consumer spends on food. Of a dollar spent on a whole food such as eggs, 40 cents finds its way back to the farmer. By comparison, George Naylor will see only 4 cents of every dollar spent on corn sweeteners. ADM and Coca-Cola and General Mills capture most of the rest. Every farmer I've ever met eventually gets around to telling the story about the food industry executive who declared, "There's money to be made in food unless you're trying to grow it." When Tyson food scientists devised the chicken nugget in 1983, a cheap bulk commodity, chicken, overnight became a high value-added product, and most of the money Americans spend on chicken moved from the farmer's pocket to the processor's. As Tyson understood, you want to be selling something more than a commodity, something more like a service. Novelty, convenience, status, fortification, lately even medicine. The problem is, a value-added product made from a cheap commodity can itself become a commodity. So cheap and abundant are the raw materials. That lesson runs straight through the history of a company like General Mills, which started out in 1926 as a mill selling whole wheat flour, ground wheat. When that product became a cheap commodity, the company kept ahead of the competition by processing the grain a bit more, creating bleached and then enriched flour. Now they were adding value, selling not just wheat but an idea of purity and health too. In time, however, even enriched white flour became a commodity, so General Mills took another step away from nature, from the farm and the plants in question, by inventing cake mixes and sweetened breakfast cereals. Now they were selling convenience, with a side of grain and corn sweetener, and today they're beginning to sell cereals that sound an awful lot like medicines. And so it goes. The rushing stream of ever cheaper agricultural commodities driving food companies to figure out new and ever more elaborate ways to add value and so induce us to buy more. When I was in Minneapolis, I spoke to a General Mills vice president who was launching a new line of organic TV dinners, a product that at first blush sounded like an oxymoron. The ingredient list went on forever, brimming with additives and obscure fractions of corn. Maltodextrin, cornstarch, xanthan gum. It seems that even organic food has succumbed to the economic logic of processing. The executive patiently explained that selling unprocessed or minimally processed whole foods will always be a fool's game, since the price of agricultural commodities tends to fall over time, whether they're organic or not. More food coming off the farm leads to either falling profits or more processing. The other problem with selling whole foods, he explained, is that it will always be hard to distinguish one company's corn or chickens or apples from any other company's. It makes much more sense to turn the corn into a brand name cereal, the chicken into a TV dinner, and the apples into a component in a nutraceutical food system. This last is precisely what one company profiled in a recent issue of Food Technology has done. TreeTop has developed a low-moisture, naturally sweetened apple piece infused with a red wine extract. Just 18 grams of these apple pieces have the same amount of cancer-fighting flavonoid phenols as 5 glasses of wine and the dietary fiber equivalent of one whole apple. Remember the 60s dream of an entire meal served in a pill, like the Jetsons? We've apparently moved from the meal in a pill to the pill in a meal, which is to say, not very far at all. Either way, the message is, we need food scientists to feed us. Of course, it was fortified breakfast cereal that first showed the way, by supplying more vitamins and minerals than any mere grain could hope to. Nature, these products implied, was no match for food science. The news of TreeTop's breakthrough came in a recent Food Technology Trends story titled, "Getting More Fruits and Vegetables into Food." I had thought fruits and vegetables were already foods, and so didn't need to be gotten into them, but I guess that just shows I'm stuck in the food past. Evidently, we're moving into the fourth age of food processing, in which the processed food will be infinitely better. That is, contain more of whatever science has determined to be the good stuff than the whole foods on which they're based. The food industry has gazed upon nature and found it wanting, and has gotten to work improving it. Back in the 70s, a New York food additive manufacturer called International Flavors and Fragrances used its annual report to defend itself against the rising threat of natural foods and explain why we were better off eating synthetics. Natural ingredients, the company pointed out rather scarily, are a wild mixture of substances created by plants and animals for completely non-food purposes. Their survival and reproduction. These dubious substances came to be consumed by humans at their own risk. Now, thanks to the ingenuity of modern food science, we had a choice. We could eat things designed by humans for the express purpose of being eaten by people, or eat substances designed by natural selection for its own purposes. To, say, snooker a bee or lift a wing or, eek, make a baby. The meal of the future would be fabricated in the laboratory out of a wide variety of materials, as one food historian wrote in 1973, including not only algae and fungi, but also petrochemicals. Protein would be extracted directly from petroleum and then spun and woven into animal muscle. Long, wrist-thick tubes of filet steak. Come to think of it, agribusiness has long since mastered this trick of turning petroleum into steak, though it still needs corn and cattle to do it. All that's really changed since the high-tech food future of the 60s is that the laboratory materials out of which these meals will be constructed are nominally natural. The relative prestige of nature and modern chemistry having traded places in the years since the rise of environmentalism. And besides, why go to the trouble and expense of manufacturing food from petroleum when there is such a flood of cheap carbon coming off the farm? So instead of creating foods whole cloth from completely synthetic materials, the industry is building them from fortified apple bits, red wine extract, flavor fractions derived from oranges, isoflavones from soy, meat substitutes fashioned from misoprotein, and resistant starches derived from corn. Natural raspberry flavor doesn't mean the flavor came from a raspberry. It may well have been derived from corn, just not from something synthetic. But the underlying reductionist premise, that a food is nothing more than the sum of its nutrients, remains undisturbed. So we break down the plants and animals into their component parts and then reassemble them into high-value-added food systems. The omnivore's predilection to eat a variety of species is tricked by this protean plant, and even the biological limit on his appetite is overcome. Resistant starch, the last novelty on that list of ingredients, has the corn refiners particularly excited today. They've figured out how to tease a new starch from corn that is virtually indigestible. You would not think this is a particularly good thing for a food to be, unless, of course, your goal is to somehow get around the biological limit on how much each of us can eat in a year. Since the body can't break down resistant starch, it slips through the digestive tract without ever turning into calories of glucose. A particular boon, we're told, for diabetics. When fake sugars and fake fats are joined by fake starches, the food industry will at long last have overcome the dilemma of the fixed stomach. Whole meals you can eat as often or as much of as you like, since this food will leave no trace. Meet the ultimate, the utterly elastic industrial eater. Chapter 6. The Consumer, a Republic of Fat. In the early years of the 19th century, Americans began drinking more than they ever had before or since, embarking on a collective bender that confronted the young republic with its first major public health crisis, the obesity epidemic of its day. Corn whiskey, suddenly superabundant and cheap, became the drink of choice, and in 1820 the typical American was putting away half a pint of the stuff every day. That comes to more than 5 gallons of spirits a year for every man, woman, and child in America. The figure today is less than one. As the historian W.J. Rorabaugh tells the story in The Alcoholic Republic, we drank the hard stuff at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, before work and after, and very often during. Employers were expected to supply spirits over the course of the workday. In fact, the modern coffee break began as a late morning whiskey break called the Elevenses. Just to pronounce it makes you sound tipsy. Except for a brief respite Sunday morning in church, Americans simply did not gather, whether for a barn raising or quilting bee, corn husking or political rally, without passing the whiskey jug. Visitors from Europe, hardly models of sobriety themselves, marveled at the free flow of American spirits. "Come on, then, if you love toping," the journalist William Cobbett wrote his fellow Englishmen in a dispatch from America. "For here you may drink yourself blind at the price of sixpence." The results of all this toping were entirely predictable. A rising tide of public drunkenness, violence and family abandonment, and a spike in alcohol-related diseases. Several of the founding fathers, including George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams, denounced the excesses of the alcoholic republic, inaugurating an American quarrel over drinking that would culminate a century later in prohibition. But the outcome of our national drinking binge is not nearly as relevant to our own situation as its underlying cause, which, put simply, was this: American farmers were producing far too much corn. This was particularly true in the newly settled regions west of the Appalachians, where fertile, virgin soils yielded one bumper crop after another. A mountain of surplus corn piled up in the Ohio River Valley. Much as today, the astounding productivity of American farmers proved to be their own worst enemy, as well as a threat to public health. For when yields rise, the market is flooded with grain and its price collapses. What happens next? The excess biomass works like a vacuum in reverse. Sooner or later, clever marketers will figure out a way to induce the human omnivore to consume the surfeit of cheap calories. As it is today, the clever thing to do with all that cheap corn was to process it. Specifically, to distill it into alcohol. The Appalachian Range made it difficult and expensive to transport surplus corn from the lightly settled Ohio River Valley to the more populous markets of the East, so farmers turned their corn into whiskey, a more compact and portable and less perishable value-added commodity. Before long, the price of whiskey plummeted to the point that people could afford to drink it by the pint, which is precisely what they did. The alcoholic republic has long since given way to the republic of fat. We are eating today much the way we drank then, and for some of the same reasons. According to the Surgeon General, obesity today is officially an epidemic. It is arguably the most pressing public health problem we face, costing the healthcare system an estimated $90 billion a year. 3 of every 5 Americans are overweight. 1 of every 5 is obese. The disease formerly known as adult-onset diabetes has had to be renamed type 2 diabetes since it now occurs so frequently in children as well. A study in the Journal of the American Medical Association predicts that a child born in 2000 has a 1 in 3 chance of developing diabetes. An African-American child's chances are 2 in 5. Because of diabetes and all the other health problems that accompany obesity, today's children may turn out to be the first generation of Americans whose life expectancy will actually be shorter than that of their parents. The problem is not limited to America. The United Nations reported that in 2000, the number of people suffering from overnutrition, 1 billion, had officially surpassed the number suffering from malnutrition, 800 million. You hear plenty of explanations for humanity's expanding waistline, all of them plausible. Changes in lifestyle. We are more sedentary. We eat out more. Affluence. More people can afford a high-fat Western diet. Poverty. Healthier whole foods cost more. Technology. fewer of us use our bodies in our work. At home, the remote control keeps us pinned to the couch. Clever marketing. Supersized portions. Advertising to children. Changes in diet. More fats. More carbohydrates. More processed foods. All these explanations are true as far as they go. But it pays to go a little further, to search for the cause behind the causes, which very simply is this. When food is abundant and cheap, people will eat more of it and get fat. Since 1977, an American's average daily intake of calories has jumped by more than 10%. Those 200 calories have to go somewhere, and absent an increase in physical activity, which hasn't happened, they end up being stored away in fat cells in our bodies. But the important question is, where exactly did all those extra calories come from in the first place? And the answer to that question takes us back to the source of almost all calories, the farm. Most researchers trace America's rising rates of obesity to the 1970s. This was, of course, the same decade that America embraced a cheap food farm policy and began dismantling 40 years of programs designed to prevent overproduction. Earl Butz, you'll recall, sought to drive up agricultural yields in order to drive down the price of the industrial food chain's raw materials, particularly corn and soybeans. It worked. The price of food is no longer a political issue. Since the Nixon administration, farmers in the United States have managed to produce 500 additional calories per person every day, up from 3,300, already substantially more than we need. Each of us, heroically, managing to put away 200 of those surplus calories at the end of their trip up the food chain. Presumably, the other 300 are being dumped overseas or turned, once again, into ethyl alcohol. Ethanol for our cars. The parallels with the alcoholic republic of 200 years ago are hard to miss. Before the changes in lifestyle, before the clever marketing, comes the mountain of cheap corn. Corn accounts for most of the surplus calories we're growing and most of the surplus calories we're eating. As then, the smart thing to do with all that surplus grain is to process it. Transform the cheap commodity into a value-added consumer product, a denser and more durable package of calories. In the 1820s, the processing options were basically two. You could turn your corn into pork or alcohol. Today, there are hundreds of things a processor can do with corn. They can use it to make everything from chicken nuggets and Big Macs to emulsifiers and nutraceuticals. Yet, since the human desire for sweetness surpasses even our desire for intoxication, the cleverest thing to do with a bushel of corn is to refine it into 33 pounds of high fructose corn syrup. That, at least, is what we're doing with about 530 million bushels of the annual corn harvest, turning it into 17.5 billion pounds of high fructose corn syrup. Considering that the human animal did not taste this particular food until 1980, for HFCS to have become the chief source of sweetness in our diets stands as a notable achievement on the part of the corn refining industry, not to mention this remarkable plant. But then, plants have always known that one of the surest paths to evolutionary success is by gratifying the mammalian omnivore's innate desire for sweetness. Since 1985, an American's annual consumption of HFCS has gone from 45 pounds to 66 pounds. You might think that this growth would have been offset by a decline in sugar consumption, since HFCS often replaces sugar, but that didn't happen. During the same period, our consumption of refined sugar actually went up by 5 pounds. What this means is that we're eating and drinking all that high fructose corn syrup on top of the sugars we were already consuming. In fact, since 1985, our consumption of all added sugars, cane, beet, HFCS, glucose, honey, maple syrup, whatever, has climbed from 128 pounds to 158 pounds per person. This is what makes high fructose corn syrup such a clever thing to do with a bushel of corn. By inducing people to consume more calories than they otherwise might, it gets them to really chomp through the corn surplus. Corn sweetener is to the Republic of Fat what corn whiskey was to the alcoholic republic. Read the food labels in your kitchen and you'll find that HFCS has insinuated itself into every corner of the pantry. Not just into our soft drinks and snack foods, where you would expect to find it, but into the ketchup and mustard, the breads and cereals, the relishes and crackers, the hot dogs and hams. But it is in soft drinks that we consume most of our 66 pounds of high-fructose corn syrup and the red-letter dates in the natural history of Z. maize. Right up there with Teosinte's catastrophic sexual mutation, Columbus's introduction of maize to the court of Queen Isabella in 1493, and Henry Wallace's first F1 hybrid seed in 1927, we must now add the year 1980. That was the year corn first became an ingredient in Coca-Cola. By 1984, Coca-Cola and Pepsi had switched over entirely from sugar to high-fructose corn syrup. Why? Because HFCS was a few cents cheaper than sugar, thanks in part to tariffs on imported sugarcane secured by the corn refiners, and consumers didn't seem to notice the substitution. The soft drink maker's switch should have been a straightforward zero-sum trade-off between corn and sugarcane, both, incidentally, C4 grasses, but it wasn't. We soon began swilling a lot more soda and therefore corn sweetener. The reason isn't far to seek. Like corn whiskey in the 1820s, the price of soft drinks plummeted. Note, however, that Coca-Cola and Pepsi did not simply cut the price of a bottle of cola. That would have only hurt profit margins, for how many people are going to buy a second soda just because it cost a few cents less? The companies had a much better plan. They would supersize their sodas. Since a soft drink's main raw material, corn sweetener, was now so cheap, why not get people to pay just a few pennies more for a substantially bigger bottle? Drop the price per ounce, but sell a lot more ounces. So began the transformation of the svelte 8-ounce Coke bottle into the chubby 20-ouncer dispensed by most soda machines today. In fact, the soda makers don't deserve credit for the invention of supersizing. That distinction belongs to a man named David Wallerstein. Until his death in 1993, Wallerstein served on the board of directors at McDonald's. But in the 50s and 60s, he worked for a chain of movie theaters in Texas, where he labored to expand sales of soda and popcorn, the high markup items that theaters depend on for their profitability. As the story is told in John Love's official history of McDonald's, Wallerstein tried everything he could think of to goose up sales. Two-for-one deals, matinee specials, but found he simply could not induce customers to buy more than one soda and one bag of popcorn. He thought he knew why. Going for seconds makes people feel piggish. Wallerstein discovered that people would spring for more popcorn and soda, a lot more, as long as it came in a single gigantic serving. Thus was born the 2-quart bucket of popcorn, the 64-ounce Big Gulp, and in time, the Big Mac and the Jumbo Fries, though Ray Kroc himself took some convincing. In 1968, Wallerstein went to work for McDonald's, but try as he might, he couldn't convince Kroc, the company's founder, of supersizing's magic powers. "If people want more fries," Kroc told him, "they can buy 2 bags." Wallerstein patiently explained that McDonald's customers did want more, but were reluctant to buy a second bag. They don't want to look like gluttons. Kroc remained skeptical, so Wallerstein went looking for proof. He began staking out McDonald's outlets in and around Chicago, observing how people ate. He saw customers noisily draining their sodas and digging infinitesimal bits of salt and burned spud out of their little bags of French fries. After Wallerstein presented his findings, Kroc relented, approved supersized portions, and the dramatic spike in sales confirmed the marketer's hunch. Deep cultural taboos against gluttony, one of the 7 deadly sins, after all, had been holding us back. Wallerstein's dubious achievement was to devise the dietary equivalent of a papal dispensation. Supersize it. He had discovered the secret to expanding the supposedly fixed human stomach. One might think that people would stop eating and drinking these gargantuan portions as soon as they felt full, but it turns out hunger doesn't work that way. Researchers have found that people and animals presented with large portions will eat up to 30% more than they would otherwise. Human appetite, it turns out, is surprisingly elastic, which makes excellent evolutionary sense. It behooved our hunter-gatherer ancestors to feast whenever the opportunity presented itself, allowing them to build up reserves of fat against future famine. Obesity